You're listening to the Cannabis Investing Network. Before we begin, a short disclaimer. The full disclaimer follows at the end of this episode. This podcast is a general communication and is being provided for entertainment and information purposes only. It is educational in nature and is not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment strategy, plan, feature, or other purpose. Please enjoy responsibly. Hello and welcome back to the Cannabis Investing Network podcast. My name is Manish, and today we are joined by someone I am very pleased to have. His name is Whitney Tilson. Welcome to the podcast, Whitney.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. And, you know, I think definitely a lot of our listeners are going to have, recognize the name. Whitney, you know, you've certainly, I think, are a household name for a lot of investors. And I think a lot of people are going to be surprised to see you talking about cannabis.
Yeah, I must say I'm a little surprised myself. this is for three reasons. One, I've never used the product.
Okay.
Two, I'm actually most famous for a short call on the sector the day Tilray peaked at $300 a share, like literally to the hour I went on national television and said this was the stupidest bubble I'd ever seen in my life and the stock would be down 90% within a year.
Wow.
And it turns out it was much too conservative. It's
down
9%. and lastly, because I generally avoid investing in speculative sectors with a lot of crazy investors in it, a lot of speculators and so forth. But but the good news on that front is a lot of inexperienced retail speculative investors in a sector leads to overshooting on the upside, but also what I think we're seeing today, overshooting on the downside. And that creates great opportunities for investors who can tune out the noise and do good fundamental research.
Well, and I think it's really interesting to hear you say that because I think the biggest problem we're having in the industry from a capital markets perspective is the question of, you know, how do we attract new capital, right? How do we bring new people in? And, you know, to see somebody with kind of your pedigree and background, that's kind of exciting for people like us who've been here for years, because that's what we need at the end of the day, right? We need more financial people to get interested in the opportunity and to come want to play in our sandbox.
Yeah, man, look, I think, you know, in the aftermath of every bust, when value guys like me start poking around and buying stocks, whether it was in 2002 after the dot-com bust, they're just incredible bargains. People could have made it more than 1,000 times their money on Priceline, which became Booking.com, Amazon, Apple, et cetera. When I was scooping up Netflix in 2012 after the Quickster debacle and the stock fell 80% and went on to be a 90 bagger in the next 8 years. I agree with you. It's a good signal when people from outside the sector, who aren't the permables, and people with fresh capital and can come in who haven't taken big losses and just say, hey, this sector, I mean, you know, very, very simply, I like investing in bombed out sectors where they're actually, incredibly enough, the companies are now profitable in this sector. It's very hard bottom fishing, you know, in the biotech sector, for example, where you're just buying companies with not only no profits, but no revenues, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Whereas here, you know, you've got real revenue. You can value things on a price to sales basis, almost everything now on a price to EBITDA basis, and in some cases, a price to free cash flow or price to earnings basis. And, you know, when you can apply traditional valuation metrics at low levels to a sector with enormous growth potential, I mean, it's, you know, as a value investor, where I've gotten in trouble is buying things that are cheap, but that stay cheap. They're value traps because they're melting ice cubes, where what you really want to do is buy something like Netflix, which is where the stock's cheap, but where there's enormous growth to come in the future. Because when you get the double benefit of a cheap stock and a big growth runway, that's where you make multiples of your money.
Right. You're getting the downside protection, right, in theory, but you still have upside, right? It's not, to your point, value traps are typically when things are going down and they look cheap because they're getting worse, not better.
Right. I mean, look, if you boil it down, the my goal in life is to buy 50-cent dollars. But if the dollar bill declines in value to 50 cents and I buy it at 50 cents, I'm going to have a hard time making money. Probably won't lose money if I'm
Sure.
right that it's a 50-cent dollar. But then if the second thing is a decent scenario, whereas the dollar bill grows to be worth $1.10 in 3 years, and the valuation gap will probably close, and maybe I double my money. But what gets really exciting is I buy a dollar bill for 50 cents, and 5 years later, that dollar bill's worth $5. Now I've made 10 times my money.
Well, I think the theoretical numbers that we've thrown out today, 10 times, 90 times, 1,000 times, all have people pretty excited, right? But before we get to the cannabis side, I'd like to just, first talk about you a little bit because you've got quite a fascinating background. So I'd love if you could just start by kind of telling people, how did you get into the investing world?
Well, interestingly enough, this I think many of your listeners might relate to, which is I grew up, learned about investing in a big bull market that was followed by a hideous bust. So this was the late 1990s. I went to Harvard Business School, but my parents are teachers. They met and married in the Peace Corps. I grew up in Tanzania, Nicaragua. I literally didn't know what a stock was in college. I had never bought a stock in my life after I graduated from Harvard Business School. I had never had anything but debt in my life, by the way, for first for college, then for business school. So, interestingly enough, one of my best friends in college to this day is Bill Ackman, who grew up in a business or real estate household family business. And so he was the opposite. I remember in 1987, in the middle of college, I bumped into him on campus and he looked terrible. And I said, "Bill, what's wrong?" He was like, "White as a ghost." And he said, "Did you see what happened to the stock market today? It was Black Monday, right?" And hit the market had fallen, 27% in a day or something. And he was in shock. And I said, "No, didn't see it, but who cares?" And he's like, "My family just lost millions of dollars today." And I thought to myself, "Oh wow, well, I wish my family had millions of dollars a year."
That's right.
But that's just a funny little story. But this is I came very late to the investing world. It was the late 90s. My wife and I got married in 1993. She was working as a lawyer. We were living in her grandparents' apartment. The best kind of rent control, by the way,
For
family.
sure. Yeah. That's
Yes.
right.
So, I remember I had the first $10,000 of savings in my life in our checking account in, call it 1995, maybe, or 1996, a couple years after I graduated from HBS. And at that point, Bill was one of the early founders of a hedge fund, and he started with $3 million and had built it up to 500 million, was riding high. And so I knew he knew something about investing, and I had $10,000 to invest. And by the way, the late 90s now were the tail end of a long bull market, and stocks were ripping, and it was the early days of the internet, and so I went to Bill, and I still remember his exact words were, he said, "If you want to learn about investing, go read everything Warren Buffett's ever written, and you can stop there. Don't need to read anything else." And so I had vaguely heard of Buffett, but to give you an idea of, given that I'm now one of the best known Buffettologists in the world, frankly, been to the last 25 Berkshire Hathaway annual meetings, and I was one of the authors of Poor Charlie's Almanac, the book about Charlie Munger, and so I live, eat, and breathe, Buffett and Munger and value investing. But back then, he came to speak at Harvard Business School, and I didn't even have the good sense to go hear him. That's how clueless I was about investing. I was interested in business. I thought I wanted to, start my own business, but certainly nothing related to investing. So, long story short, I discovered Warren Buffett, but also, frankly, I didn't really internalize value investing at the time because it was so tempting to go buy, tech stocks and, stuff that was being promoted on the early message boards. It wasn't that dissimilar to, as recently as a year ago in the market with the meme stock craze. All these jokers on Reddit, think they discovered something, new and exciting. Hey, we'll all get together and pump stocks together. I mean, that's the oldest trick in the book, and it always ends in disaster, and everybody loses all their money, which is, of course, what has happened here. Yet again, and I was warning my readers about it in my free investing daily, like literally the day that the meme stock bubble peaked on January 27th of last year, I called the top. I named 25 stocks. They're all down 80% pretty
Wow.
much. And you know, by the way, what the sign of the top was?
Tell
My
me.
cousin's 11-year-old son, he my cousin texted me. He's like, Whitney, what do I do with Lucas? And I was like, what's the matter? And he's like, he's taken his car washing money. You know, he lives out there in
Oh
Silicon
boy.
Valley, and this kid gets paid $200 to, you know, detail somebody's, you know, Ferrari.
Damn.
And so the little budding capitalist had, you know, saved up $1,000. And you know, he had initially done something smart with it, which is I think he bought Apple and Netflix with it. But oh, and a Tesla share. And we went to the Apple annual meeting, and the kid's getting a good education about investing and good companies and things he was interested in. But my cousin texts me and says he wants to borrow $50,000 from me to day trade AMC and GameStop.
Oh boy.
And I slapped my forehead, and I was like, if this isn't the sign of a top, I don't know what is. And this was the day, of course, that GameStop hit $480 a share and AMC hit $70 a share and other stupidity.
So let me just dig
But
into
by
what
the way,
you.
my cousin said no, and the kid started crying his eyes out and cursing his father. Like, that was a top, right?
That's a good indicator, right? So let's just dig into what you just said there, right? Because a lot of what we're talking about today is, you know, the broader markets and how they relate to an industry like cannabis, right? I mean, the cannabis is, you know, even though it has all these great value characteristics that we're going to talk about today, at the end of the day, it's a speculative sector, right? If people go there, we call it playing at the edges as opposed to going down the middle of investing, right? And so, you know, coming up at a time, you know, getting your kind of earning your stripes at a time in the late 90s, which is before my time from an investment standpoint, you know, maybe help us understand what did you learn from going through that experience? You know, like what did you see and how did that shape who you are as an investor today?
Well, look, I've lived through two of the biggest busts in history, the internet bust from 2000 to 2002, and then the global financial crisis, you know, from peak in October of 17 to the bottom in March of 20 of 2009. And then you could almost throw in the COVID crash, but it only
Sure.
lasted, you know, 6 weeks. But that was
Sure.
the sharpest crash in history. The market had never declined 33% in 6 weeks. And you know, each time, I would like to say, you know, I precisely nailed the top and then precisely
Sure.
nailed the bottom, but I didn't. But I sort of came close. You sort of have to be directionally correct. And
Okay.
you know, I started getting defensive and shifting the portfolio into things like Berkshire Hathaway, you know, at the peak of the internet bubble, and you know, bought a lot of it, you know, when Berkshire bottomed. Berkshire was getting hit along with the sector. So you know, it all sort of boils down to Buffett's maxim, you know, be greedy when others are fearful, and fearful when others are greedy, is sort of a general principle. So again, applying that to the cannabis sector, you know, you wanted to be selling and lightening your position, you know, right after Biden got elected, and you sort of had the election trade peak when, you know, everyone was super excited and all the stocks had doubled or quintupled, you know. And you want to be buying, you know, if as I look back over the last 5 years in the cannabis sector, there were two great buying opportunities. One right at the COVID bottom, where you caught basically of a basket of stocks, not just the best performing stocks, but a basket went up 4x, right? And now it's given back all of those gains pretty much. We're so also, I mean, there are a lot of other lessons about position sizing. Don't use options, don't do a lot of trading. But you know, generally try and you know, I was holding a lot of cash going into the COVID downturn, and put a lot of it to work right at the bottom. And just 2 weeks ago, you know, I took my personal account. I'd been sitting on about 25% cash and took it down to about 10% cash 2 weeks ago. I think we saw a market bottom there. And I put it into tech stocks, you know, a couple of weeks ago. And by the way, bought some more, you know, MSOS, the cannabis ETF that I
Hey,
like the best.
Got it. That's going to be something people like to hear for sure. So talking about, you know, specifically, you know, I think you alluded to this very nicely that in 99, you know, you're learning about Buffett, you're learning about, you know, value investing and, you know, margin of safety and all these kinds of things, right? Which are all great fundamental ways to invest. But like you said, it's very hard to actually get that ingrained, especially as a new investor, when you're watching all these speculative stocks just go crazy, right? And at that time, you know, when things are going crazy, there's always a grain of truth in there where, you know, you turn on CNBC and there's some very smart people talking about why, you know, Amazon or Netflix, you know, is going to double from here, right? Even though it's already pretty souped up. And I guess it's my question to you is, you know, did you have to get burned by living through that and actually getting burned on some of these high flying stocks to learn that lesson?
Well, funny. Yeah. The worst thing that can happen to a new young investor just getting into investing is to actually, human beings are hardwired to be dumb when it comes to money and to speculate and think short term and try and get rich quick. And I always say the surest way to get poor quickly is to try and get rich quickly. Mm-hmm. So I actually learned in the late 90s, the first stocks I ever bought, I'm embarrassed to say, were not Berkshire Hathaway, but I was speculating in AOL, and I put $20,000 in AOL, and a year later is worth $120,000. And keep in mind, this is the kid who a year earlier, or I should say, young man, I was in my late 20s at the time,
right?
But you know, where I had my first $10,000 of my life,
right,
in my checking account that got me interested in investing, and here I had $100,000 score in 12 months. You know, I thought, you know, tech stocks and high flying stuff. And I was reading the Motley Fool website and all. Uh-huh. So, yeah, I got burned on some of it. But thank goodness, discovered and really started to internalize Warren Buffett in time to avoid. And I started my first hedge fund back on January 1st of 99. So I caught the last 15 months of the internet bubble. And I had hung on, I had rolled some of my AOL shares, and I think I owned Dell and Intel at the time. So I owned, you know, I thought I was being conservative by owning the blue chip tech stocks, right?
Sure.
Just like investors 6 months ago thought they were being conservative in owning Netflix at 700, mm-hmm. and they've lost 75% of their money. That's what happened to the blue chip tech stocks of that area, most notably Cisco, which was the world's most valuable company at one time.
Wow.
So I had the same learning experience that a lot of other people are experiencing now. So I sort of make fun of the Reddit crowd, you know, doing foolish things, and my cousin, my friend's 11-year-old son, you know, getting sucked in and being foolish. But I speak from experience. I have walked a mile in those shoes.
For sure.
And got a lot of scars on my back. So, you know, one of the reasons I do what I do now, which is I publish investment newsletters, I write a free investing daily, which anyone can sign up for at empirefinancialresearch.com. Just put in your email address. You know, I try to share with my readers, you know, the lessons that I've learned, and to try and counteract all the hype and short-term thinking and nonsense you get when you turn on CNBC, for example, which is sort of funny for me to say because I was an official CNBC contributor for many years while I was running a hedge fund. So I was on CNBC every week
right.
for a while there, but I never watch it myself and tell people not to watch it.
Well, we'll include the link to your newsletter at the bottom of this, so
sure.
people can sign up, because it's a great free resource. And Whitney, you know, it's funny to hear your story on AOL, right? Because the worst thing that can happen probably to a you know, new young investor is to put some money into something and see it go well, right? Because that gives you just an incredible sense of confidence.
Well, if you put it into Berkshire Hathaway at a good price,
uh-huh.
You know, and it goes well, then you've learned a good lesson. But the problem mm-hmm. is most people don't do that.
Yeah, that's right.
And they get caught up in something. And if they're lucky, they get in early enough and can make some money like I did on AOL. But that can also sow the seeds of your destruction.
Totally, because you get very confident, right? In that, oh, mm-hmm. now I know what I'm doing. So I just hit a six bagger, right? Yeah. Let me sell this and go, you know, maybe make six more $20,000 bets, right? And if only two of them work out, I'm still really well off.
Correct. And look, the start of my whole investing career professionally, when I decided to hang out my shingle as a hedge fund manager with $1 million, you know, operating out of my bedroom on a laptop and on a rickety IKEA desk, and on January 1st of 99 with $1 million from friends and family, I had absolutely no business starting my own hedge fund. I look back and I shudder at what a clueless fool I was. I was a late 90s bull market genius is what I was, you know, but look, I had 2 Harvard degrees and I had sort of, I picked some winning stocks. And so, you know, some friends and family gave me some money and I got very, very lucky that I didn't just blow it all. And in fact, had a great 12-year run and tripled my investors' money and all, but it was a great time to be a long short value investor. And, but I got overconfident and I got distracted. And in fact, I've written, but not yet published, a book called The Rise and Fall of Case Capital, sort of detailing the investing and business lessons that I learned from, you know, a great 12-year run where, you know, I became one of the best known value investors in the world. I was on CNBC every week and hosted a conference and had newsletters and had mutual funds and hedge funds. I suffered from a number of what I call curses of success. One of which is just getting overconfident and all, but also as you become successful, and this is true in, if you're in any business, I would argue, if you become successful, generally you're doing well financially. People look up to you and everybody wants you to mentor them. Every charity wants you on their board of directors. You've probably gotten married and have kids, and kids take up a lot of time and they're wonderful. And you want to go to all their soccer games and take them out to the playground. And the things that made you successful, which are a maniacal focus, it is very, very easy over time, gradually. That's the thing. It's like the frog boiling, you know, the proverbial story of the frog boiling, you know, you can slowly boil yourself through all of these things happening. And that's exactly what happened to me. And so I didn't blow up or anything, but, you know, I underperformed the market during the post, you know, I navigated the financial crisis super well, but the recovery, I kept seeing another bear market around the corner. So during the longest bull market in history, I was playing defense and, you know, had my ship prepared for the next storm when in fact the skies were sunny. And so I just underperformed, you know, when you're sitting on cash and have a big short book during a bull market, you're going to underperform. And so after 7 years of that, I finally said, I'm done with this and closed my hedge funds. And I'm now in the investment newsletter business, which is I'm really enjoying.
And you know, this is one thing, you know, since we met up at the Benzinga conference, you know, I did some work and kind of looking into your background and listening to, you know, many of the things you've said. And one of the things I really appreciated about you, Whitney, is that, you know, you talk very openly about things that you got right, like market timing and stuff like that. But you also talk very openly about mistakes you made and things where things went wrong, right? And I feel like, especially what I've seen in the last few years, is it's very hard to hear any market commentator talk about what they do wrong. You know, all they sort of seem to talk about is all the stuff they got right. And it, if you listen to them, you think, wow, this person must be a billionaire because they only get things right.
Yeah. And look, I guess I sort of learned this from Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, who, you know, 40,000 people come to hear them speak every year. And you'd think it would go to their heads and they turn into raging egomaniacs. But in fact, that, you know, they balance their egos and they do have egos with humility. And they're always talking about the stocks they missed and the mistakes they made and engaging in self-flagellation. And it's a good, useful exercise, I think, number one. And, you know, two is I, in fact, I did write a book a year ago called The Art of Playing Defense, which is just available on Amazon, which isn't an investing book. It's more about life lessons. But it's not, instead of structuring it as a book about, okay, you got to work hard and be nice to people and develop mentors and have high integrity and get well educated, it's instead a book on, here are the 5 things that will totally screw up your life that you really want to avoid. It's, you know, channeling my Charlie Munger, you know, invert, always invert. If you want to be successful, avoid the things that will make you unsuccessful.
Right. So more about avoiding like catastrophic ruin.
And so I try to share the lessons not only with what I did right, but you know, in the investing and business world, you know, some of the mistakes I made. And one of the big ones is I went in both as a business operator, but also as a portfolio manager and investor without paying my dues, without going, it's an apprenticeship business. I should have gone and worked, heck, for Bill Ackman and been one of his analysts for 5 or 10 years. Learned the business from someone in the same way that fighter pilots learn from more advanced fighter pilots, that Navy SEALs learn from the guys with experience, that brain surgeons learn from experienced brain surgeons, where you just don't graduate from medical school and run out and start doing brain surgery, right? Investing is like that.
I think it's an interesting point, right? Because certainly, you know, most investors are not fighter pilots or brain surgeons, right? And the
It's the
problem
same
is,
process, though. It's the same process. You go to
right.
school, you get a basic education, and then you become an apprentice for many years. And you only slowly are given more and more responsibilities as you learn and demonstrate competence. And there's a it's an apprenticeship business, you know, that goes back thousands of years. And I shortcut that because I was a late 90s bull market genius. And, you
For
know,
sure.
I had my AOL went up 6x. I must be God's gift to investing. And of course, when you have two Harvard degrees, you think you're God's gift to everything.
I absolutely love that because you know it's a conversation that we have a lot in real estate where you know new people come into the business and they just want to jump to doing the big deals, right? And it's really hard to instill in them this idea that look, you need to pay your dues and you need to do the grunt work. And you know if you were to go to you know do an MBA, you would be paying for 2 or 3 years to get an education. And here you actually get to get paid for a couple of years while you earn your stripes, right? And if
It's sort of funny. You got to tell somebody, you know, my daughter is now 4 years out of college. My oldest, I have three. But my oldest is going off to business school in the fall after 4 years at EY. But I told her, you know, you need to go find a good big company to work for that can afford you because you're a net negative.
That's right.
You need someone who can afford to train you and teach you something so that you can be useful. It's worked. It's you know, I recommend that young people, you know, go into if you're interested in finance, you know, go to Goldman or Morgan Stanley or JP Morgan's, you know, analyst program for, you know, at least 2 years, then probably see if you know, a Blackstone or you know, a bigger firm will hire you, then go to business school. And then go work for 5 years, see if you can get someone like Bill Ackman to hire you or something. And only then might you be ready to start your own fund. And by the way, most people who are really passionate about investing shouldn't start their own funds. They should just always build a career working for somebody else. In the same way, most chefs who are passionate and great, who are passionate about cooking and world-class chefs should not start their own restaurant because that's a whole different kettle of fish from being a good chef.
Got it. Got it. That's very helpful. So going into, you know, this idea of you live through, you know, two big busts, right? And you know, potentially going through one right now, right? I'd love to hear your perspective on what happens in a big bust from a market perspective, right? Now we have this liquidity being pulled out of the system. We have, you know, incredible wealth destruction over the last little bit. And there's a lot of discussion I'm hearing every day about, you know, look, if there is good opportunities, and I think there's agreement that, you know, when there's forced liquidations, we do see interesting opportunities, especially in public markets. But people sort of look forward and worry about, you know, can anything succeed over the next 12 or 18 months if the Fed is, you know, tightening and removing liquidity, right? Or is it better to try to wait it out and try to recalibrate down the road? What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, you've sort of asked a sort of bigger level, higher level question, and I tend to be sort of more bottoms up in terms of, you know, I have stocks that I like, and when they get cut in half, I start to get interested, and then I think, okay, well, you know, the definition of a stock down 90% is one down 80%, and it gets cut in half, right? So
I like that.
it can be painful catching a falling knife, you know, I rarely nail the exact bottom, but I just sort of look for indicators. Now, getting back to the story of my cousin's son, who's now 12, 2 weeks ago, on May 12th, which was, you may remember, May 11th and 12th were just big puke
Really
outs.
bad days, yeah.
And I look for big puke outs that just sort of smell like capitulation. Just, I call it my spidey sense. And it's something I can't really teach other than I share what I'm feeling with my readers, so my readers
Sure.
can benefit from my spidey sense. But it just comes from a lot of experience. But so there, we had these big puke out days. S&P's down almost 20 for the year. The Nasdaq's down 30 probably, and every smaller cap or growthy stock's down 50 to 80%, right? It just smelled like a capitulation. And then I get a text from my cousin. For the first time in 16 months since his son was the perfect indicator for the top of the meme stock bubble. And he says, my son just asked me, is it time to sell my tech stocks and just buy the S&P 500? And I was like, this is it. This is the bottom. And so that's what I put in my daily that day. And sure enough, it was the bottom so far anyway. S&P is probably up 4 or 5%, and tech stocks are up 10, NASDAQ's up 10%, and growthy beaten down stuff's up 20 to 50%
That's
since
great.
that day. And that's only.
Whitney, it sounds like we need a direct line to this kid. Does he have a
Oh,
Twitter or something?
I jokingly I say, man, his name is Lucas. He's the Lucas contraindicator.
That's right.
The kid's got a perfect record so far. He's 2 for 2.
Let's get Lucas on CNBC next time.
But
This guy's a valuable
I
source.
look for things like at the top of the Bitcoin. I nailed a Bitcoin at 20,000 on December 15th, 2017, or whatever the day, the hour Bitcoin had gone from 2,000 to 20,000 on a rope. Again, I wrote in my investing daily, I'm calling the top right here, and it went down, 85% in the next year or so. And what was the sign then? A buddy of mine who's a Navy who trains a former Navy SEAL who trains Navy SEALs said that Navy SEALs were coming back from deployment in early December for the holidays and were taking their hardship bonuses, year-end bonuses, and buying Bitcoin with it. And I said, okay, when guys who've been, out there, fighting the Taliban and ISIS for 6 months, disconnected from the world, are coming home, and these guys don't have any money, but they take, they're taking their bonuses and buying Bitcoin, I look for things like that. But at the end of the day, of course, I'm really following the fundamentals. And the big difference between this tech bust and the internet bubble bust 20 years ago is that the companies today have the internet has grown and matured. And back then, it was a lot of these companies were just hype and nonsense. Whereas today, when you compare the sort of big five tech stocks today with the big five tech stocks back then, today's companies are massively more profitable, have incredible cash flows. And when if you want to go out the more speculative realm, think about a Shopify or a PayPal that are down, 80 plus percent. These are real businesses generating a load of cash, right? So I actually think it's, I'm bullish, on, you want to avoid the total dreck and companies that never should have come public, et cetera. But the same thing you can apply in the cannabis sector. The last, we had a bust a couple years ago, that was fueled by the pandemic, the COVID crash, but the stocks had already been going down.
I like that you're
And
saying we. We had a bust.
my colleagues and I at Empire Financial Research today.
No, I appreciate that. If you're part of the community, that
Yeah.
you're saying.
And by the way, when stocks are going up and I'm picking stocks that are going up, it's I. When stocks are going down and I'm losing money, it's we.
It's you. It's who's that damn analyst on my team?
Right. But let me just apply this to the cannabis sector today
Please.
versus just 2 years ago. 2 years ago, bottom fishing in the cannabis sector was a very speculative endeavor because the companies were still losing money. They were EBITDA
That's right.
negative, right? Today, revenues are 2 to 4 times higher, and across the board, you've got at least EBITDA and or operating cash flow positive companies. Now, there's
That's
still a
right.
lot of CapEx. They're still investing heavily in growth. So they're generally not free cash flow positive, right?
For sure.
But when you start seeing positive operating cash flow and EBITDA at that point, you know, at that point, there's more of a floor on the stocks. People will come in and acquire these companies. So even though the share prices generally aren't quite as low as they were on, you know, March 23rd of 2020, 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago at the bottom of the pandemic, even though the stock prices aren't as low, I would argue the stocks are actually much cheaper because, you know, let's say on a price to sales basis, if sales have quadrupled, but the stock is twice the level that it was at the bottom, well, the price to sales ratio is half today what it was back then. You know, with simple math. So the pivot in the cannabis sector just in the last 2 years, relative to the last big downturn, makes it much more attractive today. And it, you don't even have to wait 20 years to compare the tech bust today with the tech bust 20 years ago, which I also think is a very favorable comparison. But in the cannabis sector, things are moving a lot faster and I think could rally a lot faster.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, it's great to hear you make that comparison because that's literally what I was just thinking about, right, as you were kind of drawing these parallels, because you're absolutely right. I mean, the cannabis businesses, specifically the MSOs and the U.S. companies, which I know is your focus mainly, those companies have done tremendously well over the last 2 years, and they've become much more real companies, right? Now, I know it's mostly EBITDA, it's some cash flow from operations, but there's still heavy CapEx requirements, so it's not free cash flow. But still, I mean, companies typically do get valued on EBITDA, depending on the sector. And the EBITDA in this sector is very impressive, right? So I'm curious, you know, obviously you're in communication with a lot of investors. You've been in the heart of things from an institutional investing perspective. I have a question for you in terms of your typical fund, right? When they're deciding to invest in a stock, how closely are they actually underwriting a business's fundamentals versus just, you know, looking at a secular trend or looking at analyst reports and estimates of earnings?
You know, there is no such thing as a typical fund. You know, the folks that I hang out with and that I follow and all, like someone like Ricky Sandler of Eminence Capital, who you may recall spoke down at the Benzinga conference where we met a couple months ago. You know, I know the quality of work that he does and have a lot of respect for him. And when I see investors like that coming into a sector and, you know, hopefully when others see an investor like me coming into a sector, they're like, okay, you know, these are guys who do good fundamental research. I think the vast majority of money managers in the world, you know, are mostly at big institutions and they're sort of ass covering ninnies, you know, who are closet indexing. However, they're evaluated trying to do something a little bit different, you know, overweight, you know, Amazon, you know, make it a 3% position instead of the S&P 500's 2% position, you know, something like that, right? And that's ridiculous. And that's why most people, if you don't have any skill in identifying good money managers, then you should just buy an index fund because all the rest of them are just closet indexing with a lot of fees and trading costs layered onto it, right?
So it depends on basically who you're talking to, right? Who the investor is. Sure. But is it fair to say there's
most
a whole...
Most of the talking heads on CNBC have no idea what they're talking about. And you should, and that's why I recommend it's... And again, unless you really know what you're doing, just turn off CNBC. Don't even read it. There are many other better places to find good investment insight. In fact, it's hard for me to think... There's a worse place than CNBC to get investment insight. That would be Reddit message boards.
Okay. Our people, be easy on them. No. What the real question?
By the way, I wish when I was a clueless fool back in the late 90s, you know, somebody with wisdom had smacked me upside the head and told me, you know, you're being a fool and you deserve to lose the money that you're losing and so forth. And by the way, Bill Ackman did smack me upside the head, and I went in and sat in on Joel Greenblatt's class at Columbia Business School. He's a famous old school special situations / value investor, and I learned from him. And you know, so it wasn't like they took me aside personally, like I didn't know them really at the time. And Buffett and Munger, when I went to start going to their annual meetings, it was people a lot wiser than me that I learned from, and they saved me just in the nick of time because I pivoted from being a late 90s bull market genius, where I would have gotten just massacred. Like, you know, the NASDAQ went down 80%.
Wow.
80%. I mean, people think they're suffering today because the NASDAQ, you know, went down 30%. And, you know, a lot of people, therefore, are seeing their portfolios, and a lot of the growthy hedge funds like Tiger Global are down 50%. And of course, you know, Cathie Wood's, you know, ARK fund is down 75%. But it was much worse back in 2000 to 2002.
Yeah, and you know, I'm kidding about the social media stuff, but I think people really have learned the importance of, you know, having a critical eye with regards to that stuff. You know, there is some good information online. It can be helpful, but it can be very harmful, especially in a bull market where, you know, the louder you are, the more overconfident you are, a lot of times they look smarter and smarter until they don't, right? So your point is well taken. The just to wrap out the point I was asking you about with regards to fundamental analysis. You know, there's a question that I sort of have, which is that, you know, as I talk to more people in the sector or kind of larger money managers, it's kind of been my thesis that a lot of money moves in and out of sectors without necessarily a lot of fundamental analysis. Like, there's a large swath of investors who, you know, maybe talk about fundamentals, but they're looking at general fundamentals and they're really trying to ride a secular or momentum-driven trend. And with cannabis, for example, you know, right now we're in a painful period, but as that starts to turn around and go the other way, then people come back and say, yeah, there is a lot of growth. There's a lot happening in the Northeast. There's, you know, all these reasons why it's interesting, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in an ideal world, to be a good investor, you want to have good fundamental stock picking skills, but you also want to be able to layer on, good ideas about which ponds to fish in, where there are going to be lots of fish, right? And so, you know, when I made my call a couple of weeks ago and I told my readers that, you know, this smells like a bottom here, my spidey sense is tingling. And but then the question is, okay, what's the best way to play it? And I said, I think you want to be in the most beaten down stuff that's gone down 80% that could really rally. So I recommended some blue chip tech stocks for more conservative stuff, which we recommend in our newsletter. So, you know, Facebook slash Meta, Alphabet slash Google, and Amazon are our three favorites. I can't buy them in my personal account because we recommend them in our newsletters and we have strict conflict of interest rules. But, you know, I went out and I bought an ETF that owns a bunch of tech stocks. The ticker is FDN. It's sort of like an MSOS for the cannabis sector. FDN owns a bunch of the tech stocks that I wanted to own but couldn't own, right? But I gave my readers, I just said, go buy these stocks, right? But, you know, I also, you know, I bought PayPal and Floor & Decor, a retailer. I mean, the retail sector was just getting obliterated as recently as a couple of weeks ago. You know, PayPal went from over 300 to $72 a share. And that's a real business that generates a lot of cash flow. So those two didn't happen to be current open recommendations. So, you know, I wasn't buying Berkshire Hathaway, for example, which is sort of the pillar of my portfolio, because Berkshire at the time was, you know, up 5% on the year, and the market's down 20, and NASDAQ's down 30. So, in other words, Berkshire had done its job for me. It had protected my assets during a big downturn. But at the bottom of the downturn, you don't want to buy the most conservative stocks if you believe there's going to be a turn. And so I went looking for, you know, bargains in the stuff that Cathie Woods owned. You know, the SPAC sector and the cannabis sector would be three of the most beaten down. You could throw biotech in there as well, but it's not a sector I'm as comfortable with for the reasons I cited earlier.
Okay, yeah, that's a great perspective. So let's talk specifically about cannabis. What was it, you know, broadly speaking, that really got you interested? You know, you mentioned, you know, calling out Tilray as a short, which, you know, is a different world, different company, and a crazy valuation, right? But what makes you go the other way and start saying, hey, there's something interesting here?
You know, it wasn't like any one moment or one conversation or one stock, but it's a sector I sort of had been following because I'd made the big call on the short side. And you know, when I saw Tilray go down by literally from 300 to 3, 99%, you know, I do look. I have had, I'd say, only a half dozen times in my career have I ever gone long something I was once short. But for example, I did it on Netflix where I shorted it unsuccessfully. But through that long story, I got to know Reed Hastings and went out and had brunch with him, and he explained to me some of the things I was missing. And I ended up pivoting, going long, you know, right, you know, with pretty good timing, you know, right before it went up almost a hundredfold, right?
Wow.
So there are a couple other examples, like when I went long General Growth Properties, a mall retailer, that I was short from 40 to 1, and then it went filed for bankruptcy, and I got back in at one. I got back in at about 60 or 70 cents during the global financial crisis, and literally 1 year later is at $12.
Jeez.
It was a 17 bagger in less than a year, like 9 months.
Wow.
I do, having had some very positive experiences, bottom fishing, you know, correctly nailing it on the short side, but then paying attention. Because I must say, I missed, for example, Priceline, you know, which went from, I don't know, 200 to a dollar during the bust of the internet, from 2000, 2002. And then it went to 1800, right? It was almost a 2000 bagger. So the cannabis sector was something I just sort of kept my eye on, and as I saw, interestingly, in one of my newsletters, we recommended a basket of stocks in September of 2020. I'm sorry, let's see, it was right before Biden was elected, right before the election, where we looked at, it was not a political call, but simply looking at the polls, and we said we think there's going to be a blue wave. So we think Democrats win the presidency, both houses of Congress, and what sectors? And then we picked 10 stocks that would benefit in these sectors, and we picked Green Thumb,
Nice.
cannabis stock, which went from 13 to 30 in very short order. So we had one stock that really caught that run up. We got our subscribers out at $27, and then, you know, the sector has gone straight downhill for, you know, almost 2 years since then.
Yeah, we've noticed,
Yes.
unfortunately.
So I started poking around, and frankly, I was way too early and getting bullish on it late last year. And I picked MSOS as my favorite stock for this year, and I still think it's down out 30 odd percent. So this is one where I haven't had great timing. But look, you know, generally, I never go all in when I start buying, when I know I'm trying to catch a falling knife. You know, generally, I sort of try and buy a little bit before it bottoms, buy when it bottoms, and then buy a little more as it's turning, right? And I wish I could be more perfect, in my timing, but that just generally doesn't happen. You know, I was
Sure.
buying McDonald's at $16 back in 2000, at the end of 02, and then the next thing I knew is at $12, and my 5% position was a 4% position, and pretty close to the bottom, I made it a 10% position. You know, I loaded up because I got the opportunity to buy a 50 cent dollar as a 20 cent dollar, basically. So that's sort of what I've been doing. You know, I've bought MSOS 3 times in my personal account, you know, just sort of dollar cost averaging down. And you know, the basic thesis is it's more of a high level thesis here.
Sure.
That's why I've just been buying MSOS. But we have started to recommend, you know, a couple individual stocks in our paid newsletters. But I think you can do fine just owning the basket. And you know, the it's you know, what do we look for? What do I look for in any investment situation? Safe, cheap, and rapidly growing. So you know, safe is something that has, you know, decent balance sheets, producing cash flows or whatever. It's not going to go to zero no matter how bad things get. You know, cheap on ideally traditional valuation metrics, but sometimes, like on Netflix at the bottom, it was valued at $100 per paid subscriber. Like there was a valuation metric there where Hulu had just traded in a cash transaction at $2,000 a sub. So I would argue, and Netflix was a much better business. So I would argue that Netflix was a 5 cent dollar when I was recommending it on national television the day it bottomed on October 1st, 2012. So So looking for cheapness. And, you know, right now the MSOS, sort of the cannabis sector, U.S. cannabis companies are trading at about, 1.6 times trailing revenue. And that's lower on a price to sales multiple, which bottomed at two times back in March of 2000. I'm sorry, 2020, 2 years ago at the COVID bottom. So it's quite a bit cheaper on a price to sales basis. Obviously, what you really care about is cash flows, but not all the companies are generating free cash flow, so that's a little bit trickier metric to use for a basket.
For sure.
But then, most importantly, there's just a wave of of legalization that's happening across the country. And think about it. 10 years ago, there was not a single state where marijuana was legal, and now it's fully legal in 18 states. Only like 5 states is it fully illegal. And even if, who knows when they're going to move at the federal level, but at the state level, every year, another half dozen states are either via ballot initiative or through legislatures opening it up. And now, these are companies that can now move in and take advantage of this. So you've got incredible top line growth, margins going from EBITDA margins going from quite negative to very positive. And the trend lines here are just incredible. So I think it's an incredible growth sector that with the polling showing increasing public acceptance, the politicians will eventually follow the public. And so you've got a huge tailwind from legalization happening across the country. And boy, when it seems like the federal government's going to move, all these stocks will double overnight,
Right.
So I think there's almost no chance of legislation passing that's going to go in the other direction. So I
Right.
can't predict the exact timing of the tailwind, but I'm convinced there's a big long-term permanent tailwind here. And then that last thing is when this sector returns to favor, it's not just going to shoot back up to intrinsic value. It's going to shoot way above intrinsic value. It's
Going to overshoot.
one of the nice things about investing in a sector with a lot of foolish investors is you can buy at much cheaper than you could ever buy, utilities or something, right? But you can
Right,
also
right, right.
sell at much higher prices than you could ever get in, the utilities sector.
Right. It's inefficient in both directions.
Right. But it does mean it's sort of painful. Like, I couldn't believe it's gotten, I thought it was really cheap at the beginning of this year. It was my favorite idea. And now it's down 30%.
For sure, for sure. So let me dig in a little bit on that, right? So when it comes to investors and what's your experience with how hard is it for investors, institutional or retail, to invest in anything on the OTC?
Well, that's another factor here that, I mean, look, pretty much all these stocks trade, in the, with the 5-letter tickers that indicate they're on the OTC board, which doesn't matter at all to retail investors, just buying it in my PA. But one of the reasons, by the way, the U.S. pot stocks trade a lot cheaper than the Canadian ones, ironically enough, is the Canadian companies trade on the major U.S. exchanges, and institutional investors can own them.
For sure.
And the vast pools of money of the world are the institutional pools. And so for a variety of reasons, the legal and compliance and, whatever, the institutions have to report, hey, we own stocks in companies that are a federal class, whatever one or whatever regulated drug, right? And they don't want to report that. So another big tailwind, I think, is when the federal legislation passes, is and these stocks can all uplist onto proper exchanges and can attract, huge pools of new investment. But everyone's trying to figure out exactly when that is, and I have no idea and don't pretend to. And so I think if you wait until it's clear that, some bill's going to pass Congress or something, I think the stocks will have already doubled. It's it'll
It
be
gets
too late.
priced in, right,
You
pretty quickly.
sort of have to buy when there's blood in the streets.
And so just dig into that point, right? Because clearly we all get it. Uplisting is the ultimate prize. It's going to be a huge tailwind. But from until we have clarity on that, right? If the opportunity seems juicy enough for hedge funds or quasi institutional investors, how difficult is it for people to set up like SPVs or something and pool private money to in order to buy these stocks? Or do they just decide to buy MSOS?
So are you asking like for an individual investor, if somebody wants to buy in this sector, should they, can they, or should they buy some individual stocks or the or ETF like MSOS?
I'm asking like larger investors, right? So we understand retail investors can buy over the counter, right? What I'm saying is, from your, like, for example, when you were running a fund, right? Could you have been able to, A, for, could you have been able to buy MSOS because it's NASDAQ listed? Or could you have, if you wanted to buy the underlyings, could you have started an SPV and pooled money into that? And how difficult would that have been for you?
There was, I mean, hedge funds like Ricky Sandler, Eminence Capital, he can buy these things all day long. Hedge funds have a broad mandate. They can do anything. It's more the big institutional pools of money.
Got it.
And I don't even know, like, are any of the, are these stocks, allowed to be in, you know, I don't know, the Russell 2000 index? None of them, I'm sure, are big enough to
No.
be in the S&P 500, but they can't be in the indexes either, right?
No, they're not in the Russell, no.
So, I don't think anybody's going around monkeying around with SPVs, certainly not to any material degree. It's
Got it.
just going to have to, the, there's, you know, it's just go, there's going to have to be federal legislation that then cha that changes it eventually. And, you know, with Democrats and Republicans at loggerheads, and particularly with a spike in crime in this country, you know, on any kind of currently illegal drug, any step toward legalization, you risk getting primaried where somebody says you're being soft on crime because drugs are associated with crime. You know what I'm saying? Even though marijuana isn't.
Sure,
So
just
not,
bad optics.
nothing. Yeah, it's just a bad environment right now, until after the election. You know, let's and honestly, I think, I mean, look, we had the blue wave a couple years ago. And everybody, the stocks all quadrupled, because people thought Democrats, you know, were going to be able to pass something. It didn't happen. But Republicans, you know, down at the Benzinga conference, it was a Republican congresswoman whose name escapes me right now, who spoke at the conference, who's introduced legislation.
Nancy Mace.
Yeah, Nancy Mace, right? And she's, you
She's
know,
getting primaried right now, actually, funny enough, and it's
and
in
is it
like a
because
week
of
or so.
marijuana?
No, I mean there's a couple of reasons, but they're hitting her on that.
Interesting. Yeah. Well. Yeah. So I think we got to get through these midterm elections, and I think both Republicans and Democrats, there's pretty widespread support. And the states are just so far ahead of the federal government now. It's just sort of ridiculous, right?
Yeah, fair point. So what do you think it would take for, you know, hedge funds, for example, to get really excited about the trade? Like it would it be they have to see some kind of legislative catalyst, or do you think there's a scenario where these things get so cheap that, you know, hedge funds get excited about it?
Yeah, again, hedge funds are such a massive asset class, and you know, the biggest hedge funds these days, I think, are sort of the quant focused funds. So they're just, you know, playing some sort of momentum trade or whatever. So they'll start to pile in once they see, you know, a more positive chart, or going to be a lot of those folks. You know, the hedge, I think, you know, hedge funds like other investors, but probably just more to an extreme, are sort of more trading oriented and more looking for short-term catalysts. So, you know, once this thing starts to turn, I mean, one reasonable way to play this, and frankly, you know, given I'm down 30% on my year's best stock idea, I wish maybe I'd waited and done this, which is,
Sure.
you know, just wait till the chart turns a little bit. And if you miss the 20% first bounce off the bottom, you know, that's okay. It's because what we're looking for here is a 2 to 5 bagger,
Right.
as on the upside. But it's just, you know, whenever I sort of just scratch my head and I'm like, I don't get it. The fundamentals are really good and going sharply up and to the right, and the stock chart's going down, you know, every day. It's and when that disconnect occurs, you know, I dig hard and try and figure out, okay, what am I missing? You know, what is the market predicting here? Like, this is somehow a short-term rally. Like, look, I actually think, for example, energy stocks are pretty interesting. Now, they've all spiked and they've really risen hard, but a lot of people are selling them because they think it's a short-term. It's, you know, if it's something, if you're in something that's really fundamentally underlying is very cyclical, you actually want to be selling when the PE ratios are the lowest because it means the earnings are likely at a cyclical peak, right? In this case, I actually think higher oil prices are here to stay for the long term, even after, you know, at some point there'll be a ceasefire in Ukraine, right? And I look out at the oil curve, today, I don't know what's it, 110 or 120, and the forward curve shows it pretty quickly going back down to, let's say, $70. And my bet is it's going to be 90 to $100. So that, completely unrelated,
Sure.
to the cannabis sector. But what you do have to look forward. Investing is all about looking forward. It has nothing to do with looking in the rearview mirror, which is
Right.
of course a huge mistake investors make. They're driving. It's like driving a car with your eyes firmly affixed on the rearview mirror.
Right.
You have to look forward, and I cannot understand. The future of this sector is. I mean, when I look backward, I see enormous growth and very positive margin trends, et cetera. And when I look forward, I see nothing that can disrupt that fundamental, very steep positive trajectory. But the stocks just go down every day.
I mean,
And
it's
I like it's it can be frustrating if you're sort of already in and you're taking your lumps on it. But I just if you got more dry powder, that's why I don't go all in all at once, because I know I'm unlikely to nail the exact bottom. So I'll just buy on the way down.
Yeah, and I think one of the things you're seeing in there that's a concern is that, over from 2020 to 2021, fundamentals only went in one way, right? Huge revenue growth, EBITDA expansion. And part of what we're seeing is as markets mature, we're seeing price compression. So, an eighth, which used to be sold for $60, is now 55 and now 50, right? So just naturally, these industries are maturing or these markets are maturing. And so EBITDA is starting to flatten or compress, right? Although, and as new markets turn on, that counterbalances that as well, right? So there's some of that, but I hear you. There's something bigger going on,
I mean, look, the downside scenario, if we end up being wrong on this, is that yes, there's a lot of growth, but there is a phenomenon called profitless prosperity, which you see a lot in the tech sector as well, where you see companies showing a lot of revenue growth, but it doesn't translate into any profitability. That can be just because of a bad business model sometimes, but in this case, what you just alluded to is there could just be so many competitors that it just drives prices down to at or below, break even. And so you could have a lot of revenue growth, but not a lot of profit growth.
EBITDA growth, yeah.
And EBITDA. Now, look, the trends I'm seeing on EBITDA the last few years, there's lots of competition out there. And there was a lot of companies raise a lot of capital back at the peak 2 years ago, which is another reason, by the way, it's almost good to have these irrational investors that bid stocks up periodically because that gives companies the chance to
To
issue a lot
raise.
of stock at the peak.
That's right.
So they're not yet in the position to buy back stock, but at least they issued a bunch of stock, which can, fuel a lot of CapEx and cover operating losses, when the stocks fall. And of course, that's when you want to buy them. You don't want to be one of the suckers providing the cheap capital to the companies at the peak. But look, so companies raised a lot of capital and there's been a lot of growth, but the margins are still across the sector growing pretty rapidly. Now, you're right that there's been some slowing of the growth in both margins and the top line, but still pretty healthy.
Yeah, no doubt still healthy. I mean, when you're having companies do 25, 30, 35, 40% EBITDA margins, it's hard to replicate that in any other business, right? So just kind of shifting gears here as we come to the end, I'd love to, I know that for you, this is more of a big picture thesis, and I appreciate your commentary. But when you actually dig in a little bit and look for the winners in general, what are some things that you look for in terms of this is a company we really want to get behind?
It's a variety of things. I'm trying to think sort of I mean it's a combination of you're looking for business quality and cheapness of stock, right? You're looking to get your maximum bang for your buck, right? And I will say that through much of my career, once I pivoted and became a real value investor, my general approach to the world is find a basket of 100 statistically cheap stocks and then filter through them to try and find the better businesses. I should have done the exact opposite, which is
Interesting.
find a basket of the absolute best companies with the with the best brands, the best management, the highest margins, that are just, you know, the dominant companies, and then tried to buy them at reasonable prices. But over, assuming you're investing not for just a short-term trade or on one quarter's earnings, but you're going to look out a few years, you know, my general bias is to buy the best businesses, but you want to be careful not to overpay. Like, you know, Shopify is a market leading business, or Square or PayPal are market leading businesses in very high growth industries. But as investors, there are learning, if you know, pay 50 times revenues for a large business, you're likely to get hammered on valuation, right?
Sure.
So that idea can be taken to a foolish extreme. But as I'm bottom fishing in the sector, as a simple example, like I'm quite well known for having shorted Lumber Liquidators and bringing the story that they were selling formaldehyde tainted flooring to 60 Minutes, which aired the story in 2015. The stock went down by 90%. So I've learned something about the flooring industry.
Sure.
Both the two major public companies in that sector are Floor and Decor, which is a sort of a superstore concept, and Lumber Liquidators, which is the small stores concept. And Floor and Decor is doing to the industry, you know, what Walmart did to local merchants, you know, for the past 50 years, right? They were just bigger and had just a better model, and just, you know, for decades, just expanded and put the people with inferior models out of business. So I think Floor and Decor has got a better model than Lumber Liquidators. And so that's the stock I was, looking to buy, as retail stocks in general, you know, were getting crushed until a few weeks ago.
Sure.
Like I said, in this case, my investment in the cannabis sector is more thematic and high level. You know, the easiest thing to do is just buy MSOS. But my sort of bias is to buy the biggest, cheapest company in the space, which is Cresco.
Got it. So coming to the end here, first of all, really appreciate, you know, your time and coming and sharing these thoughts with everybody. So I would just like to kind of leave you with the last word and any final ideas you'd like to leave listeners with.
Yeah. I guess I would caution, like, this is an area I'm pretty excited about, but MSOS is, I don't know, a 4% position in my personal account. So this isn't, you got to be careful. You know, let's then throw in sort of a basket of beaten up tech stocks, you know, might be a 4%. And if I could buy like an Amazon, a Facebook, Alphabet, those might be 4% positions.
Okay.
You know, something like Berkshire might be a 10% position. So you just have to be careful not to overdo it, and don't try and buy using options or margin or whatever, right? You know, and don't try and worry too much about the timing, you know, having some sense of, okay, this sort of smells like a bottom, and a lot of stocks I'm seeing are pretty cheap. So I'm going to put a good chunk of my spare cash to work. But look, the most important thing anyone can do to ensure, I mean, assuming the reason people are doing this investing isn't just for entertainment because it's cheaper than going to Vegas, but rather because they care about their long-term financial future and want to ensure some, build wealth over time, and they're doing it for the right reasons. The single most important thing you can do is build your career and get promoted, generate more income over time, marrying the right person, who you have a stable marriage. Divorce is the quickest way to get poor. Marrying the right person who also has an income, and you can then combine, you can live on, you basically can live the cost of one person, but you have two incomes, right? So in other words, get the income and the career side of the equation right, then control your expenses such that every single year you can max out on your retirement plans and get that money behind a tax-free shield for the next 40, 50 years, right? And save, be net savers. Like, my parents met and married in the Peace Corps, and they were both teachers. They're now retired. They never made much money, but man, were we the cheapest people on earth. We, you know, my dad's a mechanic, mechanically oriented, so we'd buy 10-year-old cars and he'd nurse them along till they were 20 years old and we'd drag them to the junk heap, right?
Love that.
You know, I grew up wearing secondhand clothes. We never went out to restaurants. You know, the biggest treat of my life was going, you know, going to the local Friendlies, the you know, sort of like a McDonald's up in New England, you know?
Okay.
You know, just living. So live beneath your means. Whatever your means are, live beneath them and become a steady saver. And other than there are a couple good kinds of debt, most notably a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, you know, if you're going to buy a house and and all. But by and large, absolutely avoid. If you're running any balances on your credit card, you're doomed. You know, much less like installment loans and payday loans and things like that, right? I mean, we have a very predatory financial system in this country that will give you all the rope you need to hang yourself, and they'll promote it like crazy to you. So do not get sucked into that. And it's so easy to spend. And now the big thing is these they're like automatic layaway plans where you go to the checkout and they're like, hey, you don't have to pay for the whole thing now. You know, just pay 20% now and we'll spread the payment
right.
or whatever. You know, if you've got to, you know, most importantly, sort out your income and make sure that's steady and growing and don't lose your job and don't get divorced. Second most importantly, control your expenses such that you're a net saver. And then that's 80 to 90% of the game. It doesn't matter how good a stock picker you are or anything like that. You can just do what my sister did. She works in public health and she just has had money for decades, just withdrawn from her paycheck, automatically invested in the S&P 500. And she even forgot about one account. Turns out she forgot about it for 20 years. And it turns out it had hundreds of thousands of dollars in it because she had it automatically invested in the S&P 500. And then she forgot about it. Like, that's the best thing that can happen. She forgot about her retirement account or one of them. You can live a very long and happy life just doing the basics right, and you'll be in a great position. So it's only way, way, way down the list does it come to, okay, if you want to try and manage some of your own money and not just index it or something, okay, then how do I think sensibly about, okay, you know, the cannabis sector, I believe in the long-term theme here, but maybe you put 5% of your money in the whole sector, right?
Right.
You just don't want to go crazy. You just have to acknowledge, you know, as cheap as I think it is, this is a hairy sector and should be sized appropriately.
So just to recap, I think some great perspective there, right? Setting up your life appropriately, working on the revenue side, your income side, managing your expenses, being prudent. And then when you do get into, you know, the stock side of it, sizing everything appropriately. And remember, everyone at home, divorce is very expensive. So definitely avoid that one.
Yeah, my book on the art of playing defense, my favorite chapter is the one of the five big calamities that will destroy your life is a bad marriage, often ending in divorce, is the title of the chapter. And so in that book, I've got the 12 questions to ask before you marry someone, which is the first part of the equation. But then once you're married, then the second part of the chapter is my advice on how to not let your marriage go sour over time. Because sometimes most of my friends who have gotten divorced, and sadly, you know, I'm 55 now, so many of my friends have gone through divorce. And I'd say 2/3 of cases, they married a great person. They had a good marriage for the first 5 years, but then they didn't pay enough attention, and you know, life happens, and it went south. And 10 or 20 years into it, it ended in divorce. And man, that can set you way, way, way back financially.
No doubt. So pay more attention to your life, less attention to your portfolio, and more attention to your partner. Sounds like are good fundamentals. So Whitney, I really appreciate you coming on. We're going to post a link to your newsletter in the show notes. And to everyone listening, any questions, cinpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time.
This podcast is a general communication and entertainment being provided for informational purposes only. It is educational in nature and not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment product, strategy, plan, feature, or other purposes. Any examples used in this podcast are generic, hypothetical, and for entertainment purposes only. None of Cannabis Investing Network or its affiliates are suggesting that the listener or any other person take a specific course of action or any action at all. Communications such as this are not impartial and are provided in connection with advertising and marketing of products and services. Prior to making any investment or financial decisions, an investor should seek individualized advice from a personal financial, legal, tax, and other professional advisor that take into account all of the particular facts and circumstances for an investor's own situation. By listening to this communication, you agree with the intended purpose described earlier. Opinions and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions constitute our judgment and are subject to change without notice. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors.